This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM. Great to be with you on this Monday morning. And I'm happy to have on the line with us today Avi Shalev. And he is a many things, including a retired lieutenant colonel. He served in military intelligence in Israel for 24 years in different capacities. And he's even got a bit of a South African footprint as well. But what's interesting about him the most, perhaps, is this book he's written called The Only Jew in the Room. And it's all about his journey studying at an Islamic college in Israel, and it's a fascinating discussion. Avi, thank you for joining us on Chai FM.
Thank you. Good morning.
Now, let's just start off a little bit with your South African roots, and just tell us a little bit about what your time was here like, and did it have any effect on the way that you see the world today?
Well, I came to South Africa when I was a young boy, the age of 14, and I did my junior high school and undergraduate BCom degree at WITS. I studied at school in Greenside High School and Damlin College. And after I turned 22, 8 years later, I returned to Israel to join the military, the IDF, and to serve for 24 years in the military. I retired 6 years ago. So that was between 1985 to 1994, I was in South Africa. And absolutely, I think it had a very significant influence on my life because, you know, when you live in another environment in such a diverse country like South Africa, you know, it has an imprint on you, the understanding of different cultures, different people. And I think this is what drove me in the military to join units that were very much engaged in trying to understand the other side, in this case, the Palestinians. And this is what I've done for 24 years in the military, trying to understand the Palestinians and trying to explain or to present the Israeli case to the Palestinians. So I was also in a liaison unit called the Civil Administration, or COGAT, which basically was in dialogue with the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian population. And so it was, in a sense, being a person that is in between the two cultures, the Israeli and the Palestinians, trying to make sense of the reality in Israel.
Now, it's an interesting thing that you talk about making sense and understanding the Palestinians. I know of other Israelis who've not quite embarked on your theological journey, but have like learned Arabic for the purposes of tracking them in the media, for example, or just reporting on their issues, and they said that one of the things that they understood very quickly was when they started to learn Arabic, Arab Israelis became quite suspicious, because the only time that people ever learn Arabic in Israeli society, generally speaking, is for the purposes of the military, and that creates a very specific relationship. And you sort of mentioned this as part of your journey, in that although you sort of did know Arabic in terms of your military background, moving into it at a more scholarly level kind of brought you into a different way of understanding this topic.
Yes, I agree with you. I mean, what you describe is very much my experience as well. I did study and work in Arabic during my military service. So I have good fluent spoken Arabic with a Palestinian colloquial dialect, and you're right that unfortunately in Israel, the only Israelis that bother to start to learn Arabic and to use Arabic are engaged basically in security issues, and that is, I think, part of the problem we have in Israel, that both sides, Israelis don't really understand Palestinians, and Palestinians don't really understand Israelis, and we have a very specific type of spectrum or way we look at each other and we understand each other. And also, I think the failure, the dismal failure of the 7th of October on the part of the Israeli military is part of that problem. The fact that we don't really understand Palestinians. I think also the attack of Hamas on Israel and their hope that they can destroy Israel is also part of that, because we are locked in a bloody conflict, and I think we lack the vision on both sides to understand how we can actually solve our issues. And this is part of not really understanding each other.
Now, I'm interested in when you decided to go and undertake this journey in terms of actually learning Arabic and about Arabic culture. You went to an Islamic Sufi college, which is based in Israel. And I'm interested, how did you find it and apply? What was that process like? And, you know, I feel like the institution itself must have been open to some kind of open influence if it was allowing you to come in the first place.
Yes, well, as I said, I spent 24 years in the military studying the Palestinians. And after I retired 6 years ago, I was elected to do a master's degree in through Berlin University, in a very prestigious program, which for the first time I studied with Arabs and Muslims from all over the world. But once again, all our lecturers, amazing and very well known, they're all Europeans or Westerners, Jews or Christians. And after completing that degree, I realized that what I really need to do in order to understand the other side is immerse myself in Palestinian culture, is not study Islamic studies through the eyes of Westerners, but rather integrate into an Arab school, an Arab university or college. And when I completed my master's degree, I looked for an academic institution that is Arab or Muslim that will accept me. And I found El Qasimi College, which is an Arab and Islamic college in Israel in an Arab town called Baka El Garbia, which is also a religious institution. So we have three Arab colleges in Israel. And one of them in Baka El Garbia, El Qasimi, is an Islamic institution. So it was set up about 40 years ago by Sufi sheikhs that came from Hebron. And Sufism is the mystical branch of Islam. So it has kind of like Kabbalah. It comes from a different perspective or theological school. And I was their first Jewish student to be accepted into this college and to study there. I studied there for 2 years. I studied education. And during those 2 years, in which I was the only Jew in the room, literally, and this is the name, the title of my book, and the first Jew to have ever stepped into this college and did this degree in education, I started writing a diary, a journal, because I had so many different experiences, which kind of blew my mind from a completely different view from which I had experience ever and up to that point. And this journal turned into a book, which was published in Hebrew 3 years ago. In Hebrew, it's called Yoman El Qasimi, the El Qasimi Diary. And 2 months ago, it came out in English through, and it is available in Amazon. And it really details my journey into this college, my experiences, my dialogues with Arab Israelis studying there. And I think if you read this book, you have this opportunity to kind of experience the journey that I have experienced. I can tell you that being the first Jew to have ever stepped into this institution and asked to study there, they were quite amazed and perplexed. But because it's a Sufi college, because it has a different style to it than the more traditional political Islam, which we know today, is more prevalent. They have a different look at things, and they were very welcoming, and I had an incredible experience there, which is detailed in my book.
Well, we're talking to Avi Shalev today, talking about his book, The Only Jew in the Room, his experience studying at Al-Qasimi Academic College, an Islamic Sufi college in Israel. You're listening to 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM, talking to Avi Shalev today about his book, The Only Jew in the Room. Avi, I wonder, in the same way as you started your journey with Palestinians from a security perspective, obviously you said that the coverage was very welcoming, but did the students kind of initially see you as being part of did they view you as a security issue, if you know what I'm trying to say? Was that their understanding of you when you initially stepped into the classroom?
I mean, the general consent was that I was a Mossad agent that came into the room or into the class or into the college to spy on them. And it took a few weeks for them to know me and for me to get to know them. I can tell you that they were not the only ones worried or, you know, nervous about the situation. I was also very nervous, and my family and friends were trying for weeks to convince me to change my mind and not study at this college. They thought it was a, you know, a crazy idea, that I'd be kidnapped or I'd be killed or whatever. And so on both sides, there was a lot of, it was obviously not a normal and normative type of thing. And the truth is that on my first week, I was asked by the president of the college to come and meet him. And he kind of tried to work out who I was and why I was interested to study in El Qasimi. And it only kind of strengthened my resolve, because I realized I was the first Israeli Jew who made the effort to cross those, you know, those lines, those cultural lines, and study in Arabic in an Arab and Islamic college. You know, when you go to an Israeli university or college, a Hebrew-speaking university or college, a good 20 to 30 to 40% of most campuses are Arab students. And you hear Arabic, and it is perfectly normal and normative for Arabs to study in Israeli universities. But I was the first Jew to actually decide to study in an Arab college. And I think that is very telling. And so my journey, I think it was important for many reasons, because I think it should be as natural and normative for Jews to study in Arab colleges. And so in a sense, I made it my mission to study there and to get familiarized and to speak Arabic fluently and to immerse myself in Palestinian culture and to understand, or better understand, the other side.
Now, talking of understanding the other side, you've written a piece about October 7th and what we have to think about going forward next. And specifically, once perhaps Hamas is disabled or disarmed, because we're kind of still in the middle of that, but what do we do the day after? And you've got some very specific ideas about how we need to think about the Gaza Strip. You want to give us a bit of a sense of that, that you've written about?
Yes. Well, during my military service, I was a lieutenant colonel in Erez, which is the main terminal, people's terminal between Israel and Gaza. And I was responsible for all the goods and services that would come in and out of Gaza to Israel, the exports and imports. And so, and I have a very good understanding of the relationship between Israel and Gaza. And I think one of the problems we have following the disengagement plan, which was completed in the year 2005, Israel pulled out the settlements, the army bases, and in a sense stopped there. And what it didn't do was to basically create a new economic or civilian reality. And to this date, we continue to be to control the civilian situation in Gaza. So for Gazans, they feel the occupation hasn't ended. And for the Israelis, they feel they have no responsibility for Gaza, and because they're disengaged and they're not there. And so we are locked into an impossible equation. And in my opinion, this war is an important opportunity to complete the disengagement plan, because what is happening today is that we are fighting Hamas with one hand, and with the other hand, we are forced by the international community to support the Palestinian population, to supply them with water and food and services. And nobody can win a war like that against terrorism. And I'm quite certain that if the Allied had fought Nazi Germany with one hand and with the other hand been forced to supply the German population with all their civilian needs, they would be fighting to this day. And so I think Israel must make a decision and disengage completely from Gaza. That is, change the Oslo agreement and the economic agreements that are today in force, allow Gaza to be opened up to the world in a way which is secure for Israel, so that all the goods flowing into Gaza through the Gaza port or Dahania airport or Rafah border with Egypt would be inspected, so that no equipment or terrorists from Iran, from Hezbollah, ISIS members would flow in, so that Gaza would be safely opened up to the world and Gaza would be sealed off from Israel, so that the Gazans would not be able to claim that Israel is occupying them. And they would have their chance to set up their own government in a way which is free and fair, and we would get a divorce from Gaza. And I think until we do that, this endless equation where they accuse us of occupation and we accuse them of terrorism would not end. And I think we have to make that move, and we have to divorce, implement this divorce, and see how it works out, with the hope that in the future we'll be able to cooperate and work together and perhaps sign a peace agreement that will allow us to enjoy the benefits of economic cooperation. But in the meantime, given the situation, we have got to cut our ties with Gaza and allow Gazans to connect to the rest of the world in a safe way, which doesn't pose a security threat to Israel. And this is where I think Israel should work very closely with its allies, the United States and Europe, that are also very much interested in this new reality, where Gaza is free of Israeli control, but does not threaten Israel in any way. And
but,
we have.
But are there other forces on the ground that can replace Hamas as a governing entity in Gaza? I mean, you can get rid of Hamas, we're close, but then what?
Yes. At this point, I don't see any other force taking Hamas's role for several reasons. First of all, Hamas is ingrained in Palestinian society. Even though the Palestinians in Gaza are very angry and frustrated at Hamas for the enormous damage which they have endured, and this war was unexpected on both sides. Hamas surprised not only Israel, it surprised the Gaza population. And it kind of introduced Gaza into a nightmare. The situation in Gaza from an economic and civilian perspective was much better than Lebanon and Syria and Jordan and even Egypt. The standard of living there was higher. They had, you know, services and they enjoyed an economic prosperity which people in Beirut did not enjoy. And so this was very much a surprise for the Gazans. But there isn't really an alternative today. And the Israeli government, the official plan, that local tribes, because the Palestinian society is a tribal society, that local tribes, which we call Hamulas or Shire, will replace Hamas, I think is unrealistic. Hamas is an incredibly strong and ruthless organization. Anybody who would challenge it would be killed on the spot. We've known that for many years, and it is still very much a dominant force in Gaza, even though it's suffered heavy damages and a very heavy price. There must be more than 13,000-14,000 dead Hamas activists or militants, which is about half of the number of deaths in Gaza are militants and Hamas-related and Islamic Jihad and ISIS-related combatants. But still, it has a grip over Palestinian society. And we haven't reached the stage where people are there in Gaza are brave enough or serious enough to challenge their rule. So at this point, I don't see an alternative. And I must say that it is theoretically possible that the alternative will be worse, that Hamas might be destroyed and ISIS will replace it, or the Islamic Jihad will replace it, or other very radical organization, Al-Qaeda, will replace it. And so we don't really know what is the alternative. A lot of people are hoping that the Palestinian Authority will replace it. But the Palestinian Authority, which rules the West Bank, is weak as well. Its reputation is tarnished because of corruption and mismanagement. And so it's not exactly a very popular force in the Palestinian arena. And so we don't really know what will replace Hamas. That doesn't mean we shouldn't fight it and destroy it, but it's not very clear what will replace it. And this is why I think that by presenting a vision for the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, this understanding that on the day after Hamas must be very different economically, it should have all the opportunities for a prosperous Gaza, and not a Gaza kidnapped by an Islamic radical organization. That is very important for securing public support. If you don't offer an alternative, a real good, positive and hopeful alternative, you will never be able to get grassroots support for the future.
Avi Shalev, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us on 101.9 Chai FM and Chag Sameach. If you want to get his book, it's The Only Jew in the Room, available in Amazon. It's his journey at an Islamic college in Israel. Avi, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck with the rest of your work.
Thank you, Benji. Thanks for me. Chag Sameach to all of you.
Chag Sameach.